The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Howard Axelrod was in a small cabin in Vermont when thousands of protesters descended on the WTO meeting in Seattle. He was there without a cell phone, computer, or television for the bombing of the USS Cole, the Y2K panic, and the Supreme Court's Bush v. Gore decision. Howard went into the woods not to live deliberately, as Thoreau did. He didn't need a break from technology or a writing retreat. It was 5 years after a freak accident left him without sight in one eye, a loss that changed his vision of the future and ignited his wanderlust. The few years of traveling and broken love behind him, Howard needed, he writes, to live without putting on a face for anyone, including myself. The Point of Vanishing is Howard Axelrod's memoir of living in solitude for almost 2 years. And Howard Axelrod, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you were a junior at Harvard when this accident at a pickup basketball game left you without sight in your right eye. What kind of future were you imagining for yourself back then?
I hadn't wanted to imagine a future too much because the track that I was on led to law school, and that wasn't something that gave me great joy to think about. The accident happened right at the end of my junior year. I was pretty much a straight-A student, and I knew I needed to start to figure out, as my classmates were starting to figure out, where I was headed, what I wanted to do, what was important to me. But the track led to law school. My father's a lawyer. My uncle's a lawyer. My brother was heading towards law school. My cousin's a lawyer. It's basically the family business, and that's where the track was leading.
You got knocked off that track.
I got knocked off that track. So I was playing basketball in a pickup game. I had played high school basketball. I played a lot of basketball as a kid, and it was right before finals, as I said, so I went to play basketball just as a way to relax. The basketball court was a place where I felt very at home, where I felt very much myself, and it was just a freak accident. There was a loose ball. It was a rebound, and a boy's finger went into my eye, and it went in quite deeply. It curved around the eyeball and disconnected the optic nerve, which is the cable that runs from the back of the eye to the brain. So with that connection severed, I was blind in my right eye.
Mm. Well, the loss of the sight and of depth perception as well, your other senses begin to compensate. You build up what you call your spidey senses. How? What are some of those ways that other things took over?
That's right, my spidey senses. So after you lose vision in one eye or vision in both eyes, studies have shown that I think within a week of the loss of vision, your brain starts to adapt and it starts to take information from the auditory part of your brain and connect those neurons to the visual part of your brain so that you can start to orient not just through what you're seeing or what you are no longer seeing, but through what you're hearing. And the information from what you're hearing goes to the visual part of your brain so that you can start to see in some way what you're hearing. So that happened without my trying to do anything. That was just an adaptation that my brain was doing for me. But I did become aware that my hearing was more acute and that I was orienting in space in part based on what I was hearing. But then there were other ways in which I was trying to adjust consciously. I would walk up to class later because, as you'd mentioned, I lost some peripheral vision on my right-hand side. So I found I was bumping into people a lot. Also, with the loss of depth perception, it was sometimes hard to know how far away I was from someone or something. So I just tried to give myself more space and to be in places that weren't quite as crowded and to make sure I was seeing as much as possible. So, for instance, I would sit in the back of the class always all the way on the right, because then I wouldn't have to worry about peripheral vision on the right-hand side, and I would have the whole room in front of me.
Well, you gave yourself a lot of space by going from that environment to a couple of road trips across the country, some time spent in Italy and Bologna, and that led you to this one-year rental in a cabin in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. And once there, your sensual experience of the world changes dramatically. You know, you write about being attuned to the wind on your face, how your voice sounded craggy and strange without use, and you observe that in the woods, there is no sound that wasn't useful. Were you looking for silence?
Yes, I think what I was looking for most was a kind of compensation or alternative for the depth perception that I lost. So with the loss of vision in one eye, it becomes hard to perceive depth. We perceive depth based on the information going into one eye, and then the brain triangulates that information with the information going in the other eye, so we know where objects are located in space. But so without vision in both eyes, I lost that. And by being in the woods, as we were talking about before, I could focus more on my hearing. So that's another way to orient in space, not just spatially, but also with the benefits of everything that I could hear. But then another way that I think I was looking for was to be someplace where I was aware of time, because that's another kind of dimensionality, not just spatial, but temporal. And by being in the woods, I could see the stars every night, at least when it wasn't cloudy, and I was aware of the mountains. And so I became more aware of the capital T type time, not clock time, but geological time, astronomical time. And having that kind of awareness, it was another version of, I guess, sitting as far back in the classroom as I could, sort of like sitting as far back in life as you can to have the deepest or the widest kind of perspective possible. So it's not so much that I was looking for silence per se. I was just looking for a way to reorient myself through my senses and to use all of my senses to help give myself another kind of depth as a replacement for the kind of depth perception that I'd lost.
Well, it's interesting because there seems to be this kind of conflicted self of being visible or being invisible. You know, here you are in this cabin at the end of a dead-end road, you know, way out in the woods. You have contact with very few people, Nat, your plow guy. There's a woman and her very attractive teenage daughter who run a restaurant in town. Even those people you kind of want to reach out to, but something keeps you from it. What?
Well, I think that divide between visible and invisible corresponds with a divide that I felt acutely after the accident, which was a divide between my inner life and my outer life. After the accident, once all the blood dissipated and the swelling went away, my right eye actually looked the same as my left for quite a while. So outwardly, I looked the same. I told my friends about the accident, but a lot of people didn't know. But meanwhile, the world looked different to me. Depth perception was gone and peripheral vision had changed. So outwardly, I could maintain that track that I'd been on, the all-around student who was on his way maybe to law school. But meanwhile, inwardly, all the questions about the nature of reality and what I could trust and who I was and who I was going to become only became more immediate and more urgent. So by being in the woods, it was a way of letting go of that outward part of myself, of not having to fulfill any roles for anybody else, not having to put on any masks, and letting go of all the parts of my identity that came from fulfilling those roles. And the question was, if I dropped all of those roles that I played for other people, what would be there? And that, of course, tends towards the invisible. But it's not that I wanted to be invisible. I just wanted to try to get to the more interior part of myself and live from there, orient from there.
We're speaking with Howard Axelrod. He is the author of the new memoir, The Point of Vanishing. It's about living in solitude in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom for almost 2 years. Now, this was following an accident when he lost sight in one eye. So I guess he was looking for an orientation that he could trust the natural world. You know, your family doesn't know quite what to think. Somebody, maybe it was your cousin or your brother, calls you the Unabomber when you resurface at a family Thanksgiving. They compare you to Chris McCandless of that Into the Wild, that book fame. I couldn't help thinking of that movie Vanishing Point. But even if you don't know that, there is this kind of, you know, vision of American maleness as the loner, who doesn't need or want anybody else or who's escaping something. And I wonder how you see your years of solitude in comparison with this kind of untouchable male who needs nobody else.
I think in some ways I was following in that tradition, I suppose. It's not as though I fashioned myself after Thoreau, who in fact spent a lot of time with other people and apparently was going to his mom's back window to get peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and who was really hardly a hermit. But that is a part of the American tradition, or at least the American mythos. And I was a strange combination in that I was very confident still, but I was also very lost. And so I had this sense that I could figure out the answers for myself. I also had the sense that at first that heading west, which is so American, heading west into big open spaces would help me find those answers. And then ultimately retreating into the woods and into solitude would help me. And that impulse may be less American than, say, Eastern. You can find parallels in a lot of different cultures where there's retreat to solitude, to silence. I did a reading the other night at this nature center in Connecticut, and there was a sign on the wall. It was an owl. And it says there was a wise owl who lived in an oak. The more he saw, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't we be like that wise old bird? So, I mean, I don't know if that's the owl tradition or what, but I certainly appreciated that idea of the more he saw, the less he spoke. And then also the less he spoke, the more he heard. You know, what that is when we decide to try to turn down the noise of daily life and get away from it, escape from it, certainly, but also use it as a way of searching to hear something else, something deeper inside of ourselves, but then also in the natural world. And then from there, ideally, to have a way to return. So there's an ability to hear more, to pay attention better with other people.
You did have a couple of forays back into the socialized world, one on Thanksgiving in a New York town. You almost got arrested. I'm going to leave that to readers to find out. But also, you went to Cambridge, your old stomping grounds, and you felt like a wild animal who'd wandered into a zoo. So why did you decide to go back to the city?
So those first forays back were extremely difficult. I was ill-prepared. To go back to our friend Thoreau, he said that all his time in solitude or quasi-solitude made him more eager for company but less fit for it. Hmm. And that's certainly what happened with me. I felt as though, oh, now I've learned to be more attentive and to listen in a different way and to be so appreciative of another person's existence, the way you might wonder at a deer or a bird if you hadn't seen any movement for quite a while. But then I came back into the city and was just overwhelmed, felt bombarded by sirens and taxi breaks. And so that didn't work out too well. And as a preview, it made me think maybe I shouldn't come back at all. But as I spent more time in the woods and that second winter grew deeper and deeper, I felt myself being pulled towards that sense of losing the self, towards being more like the wind and the snow. And ultimately that becomes dangerous. I mean, it may sound pleasant if you're studying Zen, but certainly if you're a psychologist or a psychiatrist, it's a warning sign. And for me, I didn't recognize the warning signs for a while, and then eventually it became clear. I had a dream one night that I had killed someone, and I didn't know who I had killed, and I didn't know where the body was, but I needed to hide the body. And I was in my high school, the high school where I went as a kid, and eventually I found the body stashed in a locker. And of course, when I opened the locker door, the body was mine, the face was mine. And and the dream was terrifying. I mean, it was to recognize, it couldn't have been more obvious. I guess maybe my subconscious was saying, listen, we're going to make it really clear for you. We don't want you to miss this one. Pay attention. This is getting dangerous. And indeed it was. I mean, I'm a pretty slender guy, and I weigh 155 pounds now. And when I came out of the woods, I was 120. Mm. I mean, I just hadn't been eating very well. And I was, in a lot of ways, tending towards non-existence. So ultimately, there was a realization that if I were to keep living that way, that was going to become my life. I was going to lose, even if I didn't die, just by living in the woods like that, I was going to lose my connections to my friends and to my family and to my past.
Well, Howard, I know that when we were arranging for you to come to the studio and talk to us today, we were told that you don't have a cell phone. I wonder how you're getting on in this, you know, you live in an urban area, you live in the Boston area, you don't have a cell phone. How do you connect with all your friends for those beautiful occasions?
So I do have a landline, and my friends are welcome to call me on my landline. The ringer is off and off when I'm writing, but they're welcome to leave a voicemail message. And I never did have a cell phone, but I don't feel any impulse towards having a cell phone. Just driving here, actually, to come to the studio, I got a little lost. And I suppose if I had a GPS, that would have helped. But so I pulled into a gas station, and there was a man out front working on a car. And I said, listen, I have to be at the studio in 10 minutes. Can you help me? And he told me where to go, and he smiled at me, and I got here. You know, so there are other ways of getting around, or even if you get lost, finding your way. And I don't know, Facebook, Tinder, I'm not really curious to see what's happening by the minute. I think that if we take more time with our experiences and we're more present wherever we are, then when we actually meet up with other people or have phone conversations with other people, we'll have a lot more to offer rather than just, here's a snapshot of the sangria I had last night at the Mexican restaurant. I don't know why that would really be interesting to anyone to share or to hear about. So I think it's okay. Friends sometimes get annoyed if they're late to meet me and they wanted to tell me they were late and that I didn't have a phone, but I don't mind waiting. So then I just tell them it's fine. If you're 15 minutes late, I don't care.
Oh, Howard Axelrod, thank you for finding your way to the studio and speaking with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Howard Axelrod, he teaches at Grub Street, and he's the author of The Point of Vanishing, a memoir of 2 years in solitude. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. There may be a long tradition of young men heading off into the wilderness to find themselves, but for women, that sort of journey can be more complicated. From fairy tales to horror movies, bad things tend to happen to young women who wander into the woods alone. And those dangers are often true of the rest of the world, too. Kyle Norris brings us the story of one woman who has every reason to fear the woods, but uses the natural world to help others overcome their fears instead.
Pamela Waxman spends every minute of her free time hiking, camping, and backpacking through the woods. And when she's in the woods, she smiles a lot. And she talks slower and a little easier than when she's in her day-to-day life. She likes exploring nature with other people, but she also enjoys going out by herself. And she does that a lot. And that really stresses out her parents.
They're worried that something's going to happen to me, something bad. That either I will be attacked, or that, you know, I'll break a leg or something and there won't be someone else there to help me or to go for help. They don't want to lose me and they don't want me to suffer.
For some people, there's a lot of fear involved when women go into the woods, especially when women go into the woods alone. For Pamela's family, this concern is based in reality.
Well, my sister was murdered out in nature, attending to something she loved. Like, she was alone in a wooded area and somebody attacked and killed her. So it's easy to see a parallel with me going out in the woods and being alone in a wooded area.
Pamela's older sister, Cindy, was sexually assaulted and killed in the woods near her home. She had just turned 11. Pamela was 8. It makes sense that Pamela might not enjoy being out in the woods, but that's not what happened. Instead of avoiding the woods, she embraced the woods.
I do turn to nature as a place to be, and it's definitely linked to the fact that Cindy was murdered sort of in the wooded... I mean, it was sort of a wooded area in the suburbs, but still, like, I reject that. Like, I'm not going to live that way. I'm not willing to stay indoors and not go out because someone might murder me in the woods. I don't think that's rational. And I don't want to and will not live that way. And I don't want to set the example for other people to do that. Like, the first thing my parents did, like, really soon after my sister was killed, was send me away to camp. Which seems totally ridiculous now, but you know, backpacking, which I don't think I'd ever done. Backpacking, rock climbing, and rappelling. Under the supervision of, like, basically a bunch of teenagers. You know, 19-year-olds. For a week in the High Sierras. Sounds insane. It was totally great. And I'm so grateful that they sent me, because it would have been really easy for them just to clamp down and be like, no, you're staying with us where we can watch you. But they didn't do that. You know, they sent me out into the woods.
Did nature help you heal from her death?
No, I don't know. Have I healed from her death? Not really.
But she keeps going back to nature. Today, Pamela works at a teen center, and she recently took a group of teenage girls on a week-long camping trip. She said the girls would say things like, I'm afraid of the dark, or the woods are creepy.
There's a lot of fear. I think it's an internalized fear about violence, rape. I never hear, they may feel it and repress it, but I never hear boys and men say that they're afraid to be out in nature.
So helping young women feel safer and more comfortable in nature has become one of Pamela's personal goals. Pamela says that nature has taught her about survival. It's taught her about being normal and being fine.
And that story came to us from Kyle Norris.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In March, Tony Shea, CEO of online shoe retailer Zappos, sent an email to his more than 1,400 employees. The message began, "This is a long email. Please take 30 minutes to read it through in its entirety." Gulp. Zappos already had a reputation for unconventional workplace culture, and a few years earlier had introduced a management system called Holacracy. But the March email went a step further. As of April 30th, Zappos would be shedding all people managers, as he put it, inside of the company. Roger Hodge is an author and national editor at The Intercept. He recently wrote about Zappos in an article for The New Republic, calling it, "First, let's get rid of all the bosses." Hello, Roger.
Hello.
What happened when Shea announced that there would no longer be managers? How did employees respond?
It went off like a bomb. People were just sort of confused and frankly terrified, although at Zappos, the culture is relentlessly and sort of coercively positive. So people are always laughing, always smiling, always giving high fives and hugs. And so suddenly everyone kind of freaked out and started finding quiet corners where they could talk about what it would mean, because no one really understood it.
So suddenly people were no longer managers. Did they keep their jobs?
They did keep their jobs. The deal was that they had until the end of the year. Well, first they had until the end of April to decide whether they were going to stay with the company or take an offer, which would be a severance package. If managers chose to stay, they would have to reinvent their role at the company by the end of the year. So, and they would keep their salary until the end of the year.
I get that was my next question. When letting go of management layers, it's often a strategy to pay out less in salaries. Is this a way for Zappos to save money or something else at play?
I don't think it's a way to save money, because it's incredibly expensive to do this, both in terms of just the mayhem that it causes and having to replace talented individuals who have very specific technical roles in a tech company.
What does getting rid of managers mean for compensation or for human resources or figuring out vacation time? You know, all of those kind of things that managers do for employees.
Exactly. That was all very much to be determined. The ideal was to make everyone at Zappos act like an entrepreneur, to make everyone creative, to make everyone self-organizing on the road to teal, because this is part of a color-coded evolution of human consciousness. Tony Shea, everyone calls him Tony, was very much committed to becoming teal, to becoming a teal company.
Okay, and wait. I think I need to stop you at teal. What does that mean, becoming a teal company? Not a green company, not a blue company, but teal?
This was all based on a book that they read called Reinventing Organizations by a a Belgian management theorist named Frederick Laloux. And he has this whole color-coded evolution. It goes from reactive red, which is like bands of fighters, warlords, to amber organizations, which are like the Catholic Church, to orange organizations, which are more like innovative modern corporations, to green organizations, which are more like Ben and Jerry's or Patagonia, these innovative, touchy-feely and socially responsible management styles. And teal is a shade of green, you notice. It's something beyond green, in which there are no people managers, everyone's self-organizing and creative all the time. Well, the problem is most people in a corporation don't know how to do that. And anybody who's ever worked with a good manager knows how freeing that is. Having a good manager frees you from having to worry about things like how much you're going to get paid, whether the whims of distant executives will make your life miserable, and let you get on with your job. And so that's what everybody was freaked out about. Everybody was freaked out about, how am I going to get my job done when I don't know how to get things approved, when I don't know who to ask if I need something? You're going to have to figure this all out for yourselves, was what Tony was saying. And that's what's been happening.
So since it's important for us to understand how the company does manage itself now, what is a holacracy?
Well, holacracy is a very technical kind of, they call it an operating system for an organization. It was designed by a software engineer, and it's very hard to understand. You just kind of have to experience it. It's designed to refocus the way organizations are conceptualized. So instead of having a job, you have a role. Instead of having a manager, you have a lead link in a circle. And you have a circle instead of a department. In many respects, it's just changing the language more than anything else. The real purpose is to cut through the messy interpersonal political interactions that characterize any human organization. But of course, you get it anyway, whether you're describing what you're doing in holocratic terms or in old-fashioned hierarchical terms.
Well, I was kind of trying to imagine myself inside of this holocracy, you know, rather than the pyramid structure and these kind of concentric circles with overlapping node structure. And I would think that you'd be spending an awful lot of time thinking about where your place was in this structure and what was happening. You'd be managing the circle, so to speak. So wouldn't that
exactly
take a lot of work?
It does. It takes a lot of time. And that was the most common complaint. And there are a lot of people that are very unhappy about holacracy. They think it's too much focus on process. And everybody's spending half their time defining what their job is, what their role is. All of this is going on, meanwhile, while the tech company has been consumed with a massive transference of their whole infrastructure from their own servers to the Amazon servers, because Zappos is owned by Amazon. Mm-hmm. And so this is interrupting this huge project and causing all kinds of chaos in the tech department. I interviewed the head of that project, and he said, well, you know, I have this concept called executive interruption. I never dreamed I would have executive interruption on this scale. So it's interesting. I never could really get a clear reason why all this was introduced the way it was or when it was. I really think that this is just a reflection of Tony Hsieh's personality. He gets bored and he turns everything upside down and he likes to see what will happen.
Wow. I'm speaking with Roger Hodge. He's national editor at The Intercept and wrote about the online shoe retailer Zappos' unconventional experiment in office culture. He wrote that article for The New Republic. Okay, so you visited there. Obviously, you've seen holacracy in action. And you talked to them early on when there was a lot of confusion. But how about in September? Had they figured out some of these issues, like compensation, for example, a biggie?
They have moved in the direction of figuring these things out. They've decided that compensation is going to be based on earning badges, like in Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts. And so you earn badges. You have to design badges based on your own particular workplace adventure, as they call it. And so you earn these badges and you get them approved, and then you design them and you come up with how they're going to look, and maybe you print them out. So that's how you, if you want to get a raise, you have to earn a badge. And since all of this is just being invented now, you have to invent your own career path. So you're going to spend a lot of time thinking about these things. And I interviewed a former HR manager named Tammy Williams, and she described that, you know, that this is a lot of overhead. This is something that was traditionally done by professionals who would research what someone's salary ought to be based on their value on the job market. There were pre-existing career paths that people would go through, and that's all gone now. And in Holacracy, you can't be fired by your lead link, but you can be removed from your role. And if you're removed from more than 50% of your roles, you go to some place, a conceptual place called the beach. If you get beached, you're in trouble. The clock is ticking.
You have to explain this beach thing, because it is such a, I don't know, Lord of the Flies kind of metaphor. What is the beach?
The beach is where you are. It's kind of like a holding pen or a kill room. It's the circle you're in if you have no other role. And so what your job is, if you're on the beach, is to come up with a new role for yourself. And if you can't get a new role, then you're going to be fired.
How do you get sent to the beach?
If you have been removed from your main role by your lead link, and more than 50% of your people points are not allocated. This is a currency they've invented called people points. If more than 50% of your people points are not assigned to a particular role, you're on the beach.
It really does sound like this is the gamification of work.
It is, in a sense. And I think it's a very fun place to work. It's very festive. There are balloons everywhere and stuffed animals, and everyone is, you know, wearing sneakers and T-shirts, and there are lots of tattoos and fanciful body augmentations, and it's actually great fun to be there as a visitor. And Tony Hsieh is a very nice person. Everyone's very nice, but it's frankly, I think for a lot of people, would be terrifying.
Well, I wondered about that. If you can get an authentic sense of what it's like for employees there as a journalist, you know, when they're, it's part of the code of behavior to be relentlessly enthusiastic, I think is how you put it. Mm-hmm.
And I spent many hours interviewing different employees, and some of them were just very, very, very positive about the whole thing and thought that all the changes were good and it was going to be just wonderful. But there were some very critical people, and, you know, several hundred people took the offer, not just managers, and left the company. I think if I were a web designer or a professional merchandise buyer, I would be a little skeptical about joining a company that's in continuous organizational flux. And I think they're going to have some recruitment problems going forward.
How about other companies? Are they following Leloo's lead or doing this kind of Zappos model of going Holacracy or teal?
Yes, there are companies that you could describe as teal that Leloo describes in his book in a sort of case study manner. They're often smaller. They're often more tech-oriented even than Zappos. But no one quite so large as Zappos has embraced both the ideas of teal and Holacracy. Holacracy is almost always something that is used by small teams.
Well, I guess Zappos is trumpeting their workplace culture through workshops for other organizations. This is when they're not quite 6 months into this experiment, which seems a little young and a little bit of bravado. What do you think?
Well, they've been selling their culture for years. And what all of these changes have done is interrupt their model for selling their culture, because now their culture, no one really knows what their culture is. And Zappos doesn't really know what its culture is going to be under this model. So that might be a problem for that particular business.
Roger Hodge, a fascinating look at Zappo World. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Roger Hodge, he's an author and a journalist and currently national editor at Intercept. You'll find a link to his article for The New Republic, which is called First, We Get Rid of All the Bosses. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are some things that we see every day without really seeing them at all. And these mysterious elements of our everyday world are the subject of one of our favorite podcasts and radio shows, 99% Invisible. Today, host Roman Mars asks us to take a closer look at an incredibly important but underappreciated part of the road. Here he is.
I want you to conjure an image in your mind of the white stripes. Not those white stripes, but the white stripes that divide the lanes of traffic going in the same direction on a major highway. How long are those stripes? You can spread your arms out to estimate if you want to. Over the course of many years, a psychology researcher named Dennis Schaefer at Ohio State asked students from many different parts of the country this question.
And the most common response was 2 feet.
So if you're like most people, you estimated that those white stripes are 2 feet long, maybe a little more. But if you did, you'd be very, very wrong. This is Tom Vanderbilt.
My name is Tom Vanderbilt. I'm a writer in New York and author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do, and What It Says About Us.
Every 3 pages of Tom's terrific book, Traffic, I could probably turn into a 99% Invisible episode, but back to the highway.
Well, early on in my research, I was talking to a highway engineer.
And he said, if your car is ever broken down on the side of the road,
if you've ever been sort of forced to get out of your vehicle on a highway,
just take a moment to notice what a strange landscape it is.
If you happen to be standing near a road sign, these road signs are huge. I mean, they're not meant to be experienced as humans on foot. They're meant to be experienced at 75 miles an hour.
With the clear view typeface.
Perfectly visible, retro-reflective.
And then there are the white stripes.
If you actually kind of got out of your car and were able to walk on a closed highway and walk from one end of those stripes to the other, you'd find that, I mean, years ago in the United States, the highway standard was 15 feet long, which is longer than a car itself.
Current Federal Highway Administration guidelines suggest a length of 10 feet with 30 feet between the dashes.
That's something that is shocking to people.
And remember, most people in the Schaefer study said that those stripes were 2 feet long.
That's such a vast gulf there between. It's not sort of like, they're actually 5 feet. We thought they were 2, margin of error kind of thing.
And it goes back to this fundamental point that when you're in a car at high speeds, you're experiencing only a sense of the landscape rather than the actual landscape.
This kind of sense of the landscape has been presented to you to essentially make you feel comfortable.
And to make a highway work at what are really evolutionarily ridiculous speeds for a human to travel.
You have this big, flat, wide open, kind of stretch of road that even if you have a 65 mile an hour sign, the message of the road is telling you something entirely different. And I think that's really where a lot of our behavior comes from. Sometimes, you have sort of willful speeding, willful kind of law breaking, but a lot of it is just people are paying attention to the visual messaging of the road, not to their speedometer.
Long dividing lines and clear vistas give the illusion that you're going at a reasonable speed. As soon as something encroaches into view, you get a sense of how fast you're going. That's one reason why those temporary concrete walls that crews put up right next to the road during construction are so unnerving. The error in perception of white stripe length is attributed to the fact that when we drive on the highway, we tend to look so far ahead that we usually only experience the dashes and gaps when they are very far away and at an angle where they look shorter. But there's no consensus as to why people all over the country were so consistently wrong with the 2 feet estimate.
Become one of my favorite cocktail party, facts.
Mine too.
Stump the driver with this white stripes information.
I don't want to leave you with the impression that the white dividing lines are uniform, though.
You won't find, 10-foot highway lines on, a boulevard in New York City.
And you probably won't find 10 or 15 foot stripes on bridges or highway on-ramps.
Or let's hope you don't, because that's an entirely inappropriate design language for that space.
Limited access highways are designed for a very precise purpose.
There's the highways meant for uninterrupted, fast flowing traffic, get people from point A to point B as quickly as possible with no interruptions. I mean, that sort of environment does not work in cities or suburbs.
The problem is when that approach is grafted into places where it doesn't belong.
I think we're actually kind of paying the price for this right now in some suburban environments where you find these kind of arterial highways that were built almost to a highway engineering standard with, again, these long sight lines, wide roads, encouraging people to go fast. And then we went and built all kinds of development along those arterial highways, which was never really supposed to be there.
But with so many people driving on these roads, they became absolutely irresistible to commerce.
This is kind of the new American main street, right? Where you have your Costco's and your fast food and all sorts of in and out parking lots, driveways, drive-throughs, yet people also going very fast. And a guy named Eric Dumbaugh does a lot of research suggesting that these are really some of the most dangerous places to currently drive in America, not crowded urban cities, which is what a lot of people would think.
The whole approach is called the forgiving road.
The idea was that, you know, to first try to minimize the potential that a crash could happen through, again, through lack of obstacles, you know, generous sight lines, all these sorts of things. But then if a crash did happen, to kind of mitigate the effects of what would happen, to not punish the driver for the mistake that he will inevitably make. This was, I'm quoting some of the language from the time. So you see that nowadays in things like in California, you'll have your guardrails that are sort of wire guardrails that if a car strikes that guardrail, it tends to catch on the guardrail rather than being bounced back out into traffic, which causes another series of collisions.
So this forgiving road is a positive thing in terms of good safety engineering.
But they were so sort of seduced by it that the call was made to bring it into even the surface street network. So things like street trees began to be deemed hazards by engineers, just outright hazards. I mean, and that makes sense on a high-speed country road, but if you're talking about a residential street where you're not supposed to be going more than 25 anyway, is the presence of a street tree on the side of the road where it's providing shade and comfort to pedestrians, you know, is that the same sort of hazard? Is it even a hazard at all?
The conclusion many planners came to was yes, trees are a hazard.
You find pre-war suburbs, you have the street, a set of trees, and then the sidewalk. Post-war, this sort of shift began to happen where the trees were moved on the other side of the sidewalk.
Suddenly, pedestrians were put into the position of being the buffer between drivers and those menacing trees.
There was sort of a pernicious thing that happened here is that, you know, as you move those trees away, the visual sensation of the road became wider. And if there's one kind of iron law of traffic engineering, it gets into this visual perception thing as well. The wider a road is or is perceived to be,
the faster driver speed tends to increase.
And of course, you know, the final, if you look at sort of 1990s era, you know, suburbia, that they just kind of eliminated the sidewalk and the trees altogether. So that was sort of the final solution, just eliminate any kind of hazard.
And Tom Vanderbilt says you can almost date a subdivision's development based on that shift.
And this points to one of the problems about road engineering is that humans tend to consume the extra engineering measures that have been built in for their safety. Much in the same way, I like to draw the analogy with some of the research that's been done on food packaging by Brian Wanzek at Cornell University. You're doing experiments where, you know, if you give people, just random group of people, large buckets of popcorn filled to the top with popcorn and give them a smaller amount of popcorn in a smaller package, they'll just eat more of the larger package, it has nothing to do with their level of hunger. It's just the size of the package influences their behavior. And I think a lot of our road environments are sort of like that. They're over-engineered for the safety, and then we tend to consume a lot of the extras, getting us back to this kind of homeostatic edge that we're always kind of playing with, I think.
99% Invisible is Sam Greenspan and me, Roman Mars. It's a project of 91.7 local public radio, KALW in San Francisco, and the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor. If you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. It'll help others to find it and unites you with our mission to share information, stories, and ideas by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is
produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.